Good afternoon, everyone. How are you doing? Did you have a good lunch? I hope. Welcome to the first afternoon session of TechEd 2011 Australia. My name is Dan Holm, and as you know, this session is about designing governance, which is really the technical side of governance and how you create a governable SharePoint implementation. Obviously, it's a topic of great interest to all kinds of people. We'll dive in pretty quickly here. Let me give you a quick introduction to who I am. My name is Dan Holm. I'm actually based in Maui, Hawaii, so that screenshot you saw just for a brief moment there is actually down the hill from my home. I spend my life traveling around the world, actually, speaking at events and spending a lot of time with customers across all kinds of industry verticals, government, commercial, academic, all kinds of company sizes, although primarily larger organizations. And one thing everyone shares is a real concern about governing this service called SharePoint that is taking over our lives in IT. And I was lucky enough about 5 months ago to take a job as the chief SharePoint evangelist for AvePoint, whom, as you know, is the premier sponsor of this event. And my job for AvePoint is to specifically help us as the community, excuse me one second, sorry, to help us use SharePoint more effectively. My job is really to help all of us succeed with SharePoint, and hopefully today will be a big help to you, and then as we go through the rest of the event and on into the future, I hope you don't hesitate to turn to me and hit me with your questions, allow me to help you do what you're trying to do for your organization. I've been an MVP in SharePoint Server for 5 years now. I actually started with SharePoint in the version 2 phase as part of my job as the Microsoft Technologies Consultant for NBC Olympics. NBC is one of the major television networks in the United States, and I am their consultant on the Olympic Games. So back in the days of Torino, the Winter Olympics in 2006, we were able to implement a mission-critical application that was required by our engineering group in the middle of a broadcast, during which there is $1 billion of revenue online, and we were able to do it in a matter of 8 hours, thanks to SharePoint. That's where I fell in love with SharePoint, and as I'm sure many of us have encountered, that one little spark that allowed people in our organization to see what SharePoint was capable of quickly turned into a raging forest fire, and SharePoint just proliferated throughout the organization. And just like you, probably, we at NBC Olympics are fighting our own governance battles as well. But that's one of the jobs I have, and we're in the process of getting ready for the London 2012 Games right now. I'm also obviously a speaker at these events. I'm a columnist for SharePoint Pro Magazine. So we have a weekly newsletter that has information for business, technical, IT pro roles, as well as for developers. And if you're not a subscriber, I highly recommend you jump up to SharePointProMag.com and subscribe. It's a good newsletter. And finally, I'm the author of the SharePoint 2010 Training Kit, which prepares you for the 7667 exam, and this is the official training kit from Microsoft Press. This book will actually be released hopefully within the next 3 weeks here. It didn't quite make it in time for this event, but we are going to do a book signing nonetheless downstairs. We've got fake covers that we're going to sign so that when you do get your copy of the book, you can just stuff it right in there. That means it's free. You can get a signed book without even buying a book. So come on down. We'll be doing that tomorrow during lunch as well. Last but certainly most importantly, my email address and Twitter handle. As I mentioned, my job is to help you succeed with SharePoint, so never hesitate to send me a question. I will do my best to answer it for you. And because I am doing all of these other things at the same time, I'll give you one little tip. My inbox, I get to about this much at the end of every day. So if you don't hear right back from me, re-email me. Stay at the top of my inbox, and I'll do my best to answer your questions. And also, you can follow me on Twitter. This is a SharePoint Twitter handle for me, so you will not hear that I went to the gym and checked in at the best juice bar on the planet, but you will hear what I'm thinking about as far as SharePoint. So those are some good resources for you. Now, obviously, we're here to talk about governance, all of us should be concerned about governance, I'm sure. How many of us, though, have heard more than one definition of what governance actually is? Yeah, there's a lot of noise about governance right now, and so I'd like to start by telling you my definition, which is just one more for you, but hopefully it will start giving you some context, not only for how to talk about governance in your organization, but also for the rest of this session. So first, We all know that SharePoint is a service, right? SharePoint is doing something for our organization. Yes, it's a technology, but that's not what matters. There's lots of other technologies out there. What matters is the business value we're getting out of SharePoint. It's a service. So we stand up this service, and then people start wanting things from it. And as most of us have probably found out, they start wanting more and more and more, faster and faster and faster. And so people start throwing requests at this service that we've stood up. And we have to be able to respond to those requests and deliver business value, or people will go out and find out how to do it themselves, perhaps outside of our service, and then we get into an unmanaged set of services. Now, I had a customer last week who told me that one of their end users wanted something badly and requested it, and after 1 week hadn't heard back from IT. So the following week, IT got an email from the user that said, here's how to do what I want in SharePoint. Add this to program files, change the GAC, make this change to web.config, and then I'll be able to do my job. That is not what you want users to request. You want them to say, I need to automate this workflow and to have this form. They need the business case. That is what you want them doing. You don't want them in the business of telling you how to actually do it, because often they won't know. Or what they'll be asking for is just completely unreasonable. And so there's this thing called governance that we build around the service as the interface between the service itself and our customers, our end users. Governance allows for requests to come in a logical, defined process, and for users to understand what they can expect back out of the service, to understand what functionality is possible, and if it's not possible today, when it will be possible, perhaps what the costs are involved for the service, what the SLAs are for the service. So governance is really a wrapper around the service, and it's what allows us as an organization to manage that service effectively as a service. Now, I like to think of governance as defining the people, processes, policies, and technologies that deliver a service. Now, a lot of the documentation out there in the community talks about people, talks about putting together the right stakeholders, executive sponsorship. They talk about process and the different change management models that you can go through to manage a service. They talk about policy, and that's a very important piece of understanding what policies you have to enforce to remain compliant, secure, etc. But I find that many of the governance resources out there skip one of the most important pieces, in my opinion, which is technology. Technology is important for a couple of reasons, in my opinion. First, because you can't govern something unless you know what it is you're governing. You need to understand the technology and what you're asking of it. So to give you a really extreme example, you can't have in your governance plan that your entire SharePoint farm will be backed up every 2 minutes. Really, right? That's just not physically possible for the technology. You have to understand what the technology is capable of doing, how to get that out of the technology before you can govern the technology and promise that that's what's going to be delivered to your customers. Secondly, if you are using technology correctly, technology can help you enforce and automate your governance. And that's one of the things we're really dealing with here today in this session, is how to create a governable architecture that aligns with your governance plan. Because if your architecture is A and your governance says you're going to do B, you're never going to make it work. You will feel pain. And so we need to align those things. So technology is important both as an input into your governance plan and as a supporting mechanism of your governance plan moving forward. So I like to think of governance as the people, process, policy, and technology that surround a service and make it possible to deliver to your end customers. Now, in this session today, we're going to go through a four-step process for how you create a governable SharePoint service. And it's going to involve gathering requirements and then understanding which requirements drive different design decisions. So one of the outcomes of this session is to really understand why you might need to go with one architecture or another, why you might need one farm or 10 farms, why you might need one web application or 7, why you might need one site collection or 15. Same with physical and database sorts of architectures as well. So we're going to go through this process, and what we're going to find is that the architecture and the technology that you have to put into SharePoint to deliver a governable service is going to be highly disjointed and decentralized. And the reason is your governance, the way your information needs to be managed, is probably more than one definition. I would imagine that the way you manage, let's say, a marketing presentation, is a little bit different than the way you manage a contract. Safe to bet. Now, because you're going to have two different definitions of how these things have to be managed, you're going to have two containers to scope your management to, and you're going to end up with a very, very disjointed physical and logical architecture. Now, that does not mean you can't present that architecture to your end users in a very logical fashion. And so the whole idea of site maps and navigation and information architecture is definitely achievable on top of a manageable service. And so that's where we're going to be getting to, among other things. And so our objectives are going to be to define governance, which we've already done, to look at management controls and scopes, and then to really make sure that everyone's completely clear about the difference between information architecture and management. It's a really key distinction that if you're not familiar with, I want you to be able to go back to your enterprise and communicate to the other stakeholders in your governance plan. Then we'll go through this four-step process of architecting governance once with a real simple example so you can understand the four steps. And then we're going to go into all kinds of examples of different architectures and why certain requirements would lead to those architectures. And last but not least, what isn't on the slide because I wasn't sure I was going to get it in time, is a demonstration of how you can then, if with a well-architected environment, use SharePoint to help automate governance. And so we'll have some time and hopefully a brand new really cool demo on automating governance. So with that, if you're not in the right session, feel free to leave because that's what we're going to be talking about. And the first thing we're going to dive right into here is looking at management controls and scopes. This is just a definition that I want to make sure as I use the phrases that you're comfortable with as well. So if you look at the logical architecture of SharePoint, as well as the physical, this is the diagram of the object and containment hierarchy of SharePoint. You have your farm. Inside your farm, you have one or more web applications. Each web application has one or more content databases, which have one or more site collections, which then have one or more sites, which can have lists, libraries, folders, items, etc. So you've got this hierarchy of objects. A web application is generally going to be connected to one or more service applications, like search and metadata, and a web application will have at least one zone, perhaps more zones. So you've got these different objects in your architecture. And each of these objects have switches and configurations that you can apply. So for example, we all know that if you want to apply security permissions in SharePoint, you can do it basically anywhere down here. You can apply security permissions to a site, to a subsite, to a list or library, to a folder, to an item or document. So this one particular management scope can actually be applied in several places. And so we're all probably comfortable with the idea that if one team needs access to data, another team needs access to different data, and you don't want them seeing each other's data, you're obviously going to have probably two containers to scope that, right? You need a container to scope your management, which in this case is just permissions. Now, what happens as soon as you have more than one container? And let's say you've got a certain user, like your CEO, who needs access to both sets of content. You obviously have a little headache because now you have to go add the CEO to both containers, right? So as you scope your management into different containers, you are simultaneously making your manageability a little bit more difficult because now you've got multiple containers and you're going to have to start doing things multiple times. So that's a simple example of sort of the yin and yang of management. In order to manage something more effectively like security, you make the manageability of the service a little bit more difficult. Does that make sense? All right. Now, another quick example of a management scope and control is blocked file types. So if you want to put podcasts on your intranet, but you don't want users uploading their MP3 collections into their team sites, you're going to have two web applications for that because blocked file types is only scopable at the web application level. So your intranet allows MP3s. Your remaining sites don't. You have to have at least two containers to do that. And again, once you have multiple containers, what does that mean? Well, it means you're going to have at least two site collections, one in each. You'll have a lot more. And that means that when you go to audit, you're going to have to audit separate places now. So again, just another example of a simple management scope and the fact that it drives you into different containers. And there's lots of other management controls that are scoped to each level of the hierarchy. And we'll be looking at some specific examples as we continue on. So the bottom line is it's all about containers, scopes for your management. And as soon as, just as with security, as soon as you have more than one scope, you end up having problems. And governance is more than, and governance and management is more than just security. So you're going to have more containers than you ever wanted. And that's going to make your manageability a little bit difficult. So at the very end of this story, we'll be talking about how you take an architecture that you've now made support your governance and management requirements, and now make it manageable. And that's going to be at the end of the story. So as we go along and you start looking at this and going, God, this is complicated and this is way more than I wanted, realize, you know, there is an end to the story as well that will make it easier. Now, any questions just on that concept? Everyone cool with that? All right. The other key sort of fundamental is the difference between information architecture and management. When I go into a number of customers and I ask them what they're planning to do with SharePoint, they give me something like this. They give me what I would call a site map. And sometimes they've just sat down and sort of drawn it out. Sometimes they've done an information architecture exercise, and they've come up with this site map. And this is good. This is important. But it is not the same as manageability. This is, or management. This is an information architecture view of the world. And information architecture, as a discipline, is about organizing and describing content. It's about saying we have certain content types and metadata. These content types are related to each other one way or another. And the way you go through an information architecture exercise is you pull together your knowledge management teams, your subject matter experts, your content owners, and everyone sits down and decides how they're going to think about this content. And the outcomes of information architecture are your sitemap, taxonomy, search, like best bets and terms and things like that, and maybe targeting, saying certain content should be more visible to certain users and otherwise around. So it's all about describing content. And let's just take the sitemap as an example. How many of you think that if you were to draw out your intranet today and decide how it's going to look to get users around your organization, that it's going to look exactly the same 5 years from now? Yeah, right? It's not going to happen. Organizations change. The way we think about content, the way we structure content, our organization chart changes. And so the way we describe and think about content is guaranteed to change over time. It will get more refined, we'll get better at it, but we'll also get different at it. And so information architecture doesn't change so much. I think it's safe to bet that if you think about the fact that you have to maintain a contract for 7 years in order to be compliant with XYZ regulation, that's a lot more likely to be the same 5 years from now as it is today. And that takes us into the concept of what management is all about. Management is about managing the content itself, managing the service behind that content. It's about defining things like security permissions, retention, life cycle, how content gets created and removed from your environment, storage. And the way you put together a management definition is by looking at your information management policies that say a contract must be retained for 7 years. You'll have a policy or some kind of understanding that that's what's supposed to happen. Your IT usage policies that say users should or shouldn't do something. Users should not store MP3s on company property. Okay, that's a policy. That's important. Your regulatory environment, service level agreements, all of those things go into defining how you're going to manage content and the service itself. Hold on. Let's see what's going on here. Part of it is my mic slipped. Good? All right. The outcomes of a management exercise are definitions of access levels, of records management, of compliance. So if you've done information management well, you should be heading towards a compliant service. And also performance. If you don't go through information management well, you will absolutely hurt your performance. There we go. Cool. So there's a big difference between how you describe the content and how you manage the information. And again, we're going to be focusing on why the management side really needs to drive our design. It's going to look very different than the information architecture side. But the good news is we'll then be able to lay the information architecture on top of the management. So the management will be very stable, very defined, very scalable, very high performant. But the information architecture will allow users to get to content the way they want to. The information architecture is virtual, so it can change over time. But the way we manage the information behind the scenes stays the same. Does that make sense? Okay. So those are the fundamentals. Now let's dive through into the process of architecting governance, which is a four-step process. And we'll go through each of these steps, but it's about gathering requirements, going through two different phases of design focused on different requirements, and finally, overlaying information architecture and manageability on top of your design. So first, defining and classifying your requirements. Now again, we're going to go through this real quick with one simple example, and then we'll be going through lots of detailed examples. So let's start with the example of human resources. Let's say the human resources team is driving our upgrade to SharePoint 2010. They want to work with certain types of information. And so we sit down with them and we gather some requirements. Let's jump over to OneNote here. And HR people are very touchy-feely, so they like their little iDevices. So we're going to use an iDevice here. What are some requirements that HR tends to have? Privacy. Yeah, they need to maintain privacy. That's probably requirement number one. So oops, let me make sure I've got my little ink on going on here. Whoops. I'm going to have to sit down at the desk because I can't use my palm. Oh. Come back. Well, that might not work. Let's get that going again. Hooked up. I didn't like the fact that I swiped between modes there. All right, well, we're going to skip that for now. That little technical bit didn't work. So privacy is certainly a key one. Let's switch to normal mode here. What else? What? Huh? Retention, certain retention. So certainly employment agreements, things like that need to be retained. What are kinds of things are they going to want from this service? Sorry, ability to audit, so insight and auditing. Any other thoughts? These are some good ones. Okay. And actually, I do want to draw here. So give me 1 second to just restart this little app here. There we go. Okay, so those are some good requirements. So let's take a look at then, and there are obviously going to be more, but that gets us going. Let's then take a look at the next step here, which is how we start actually turning these into design decisions. And there's two phases of design. One is looking at the actual management requirements, and the other is then looking at more business and functionality types of requirements. So let's jump back to OneNote here. And I guess we can just scroll down. Be in mirror mode. Okay. So let's say we also are going to be supporting marketing and some efforts for them to collaborate on some marketing materials. We know that HR is going to want some privacy, and that's obviously a very, very common concern for HR. And what does privacy actually mean? Well, this is one of the things you'd want to tease out from them, but I've been in extreme sort of examples where basically HR's stance was nobody gets access to this information. Only HR has access, to the point where we even have to sit down and discuss why it is and how it is that administrators can and can't get to information, which is a whole different topic. But we'll say at least that it needs to be completely separate from finance. If HR is going to have that much control over their part of our service, they're going to need to be able to do things at the site collection level that enable them to turn on and off features, to assign permissions, and those kinds of things. They're going to need to have a site collection that over which they have ownership. So we know for sure that we're going to have a separate site collection for HR than we might have for finance in order to scope privacy, for example. Now, as soon as we do that, we're going to make insight and auditing possible within each site collection. SharePoint out of the box gives you the ability to audit what's going on within a site collection. But if we're going to look at the enterprise level and try and get compliance reports, we're now going to have two separate containers that we're going to have to pull that out. So again, that's the yin and yang of better information management, but more difficult manageability. Now, once we've gone through the decisions of what containers allow us to scope our requirements, in this case, privacy, We then can go to the third step, which is taking that design, that architecture that we've created, and refining it for specific business requirements. So let's say, for example, that HR wants to have a blog that they can use to communicate with each other within HR. We know that in SharePoint, blogs are implemented as a site definition, right? So in order to have blogs, you have to have a site for that blog. It's not done with a list or library. So we know we're going to have to eventually have another site within that site collection for blogs. And maybe they're going to want to have a subset of HR that's responsible for recruiting, and they want to have the ability to collaborate around recruiting activities. In order to secure that and apply permissions, we might find that the best way to scope that is also with a subsite for recruiting. So we go through the process of first defining where we need scopes to meet our management requirements. Once we've completely finished that and we have either the farms, web apps, content databases, site collections, zones, all those pieces that we need for managing information, we can then start breaking that a little bit further down based on specific business requirements. Now, the last step in this four-stage process is to overlay navigation and manageability. So we go through and we define our architecture, which we've just sort of done here. And then on top of that, we just talked about all that, we overlay our information architecture and manageability. So for example, if we're going to create an intranet with which to navigate as a user, we know the intranet is going to be some separate container because the intranet is going to be basically available to all employees. HR wants complete privacy over their information. So we're going to have an intranet. We're going to need to create links that allow people to go from somewhere on the homepage of the intranet to HR and to finance. So we will overlay that navigation on top of the physical architecture that we've got. So we gather requirements, very simply said, we gather the requirements, we build an architecture, physical and logical, that meets the information management requirements, and during that phase, we don't pay attention to business requirements, just true information management. Then the third step is to look at any business requirements that drive us to further refine our design, and then the fourth step is to actually go back and look at any information architecture requirements that might drive how we choose to navigate to this particular set of content today, and that, of course, might change tomorrow. Does that make sense so far? Just at a high level? Okay. So now the next thing we need to do is dive into lots of examples of where this starts to get really challenging and where different management controls are scoped. So we're going to go through the process one more time in a lot more detail. The first phase is classifying and defining your requirements. We did a little bit of that with our HR organization. As you do gather requirements, you should group those requirements into these categories. The first sets of requirements are those that are true business requirements. The business is trying to achieve X. And in a business requirement statement, there should be no definition of technology. SharePoint should never be mentioned. Cold Fusion should never be mentioned. Outlook Exchange should never be mentioned. A business requirement is a business goal. And if you've done this right, there should be no mention of technology. Now, the next set of requirements that you'll find yourself gathering are technical requirements. And technical requirements are generally those that relate to how different pieces that are already in place in your organization work together. So they shouldn't necessarily drive new technical requirements. They should be about interoperating with existing. So as an example, let's say in our HR organization, they want to be able to access the recruiting site from their iPads. They already have iPads, so they have a technical requirement to provide access. That's a valid technical requirement. What you want to avoid as you're in the requirements gathering stage is someone saying, I need a site to do X, or I need a list or library to do X, because that is saying what the end design should be. The end design should be derived from the requirements. The requirements should not specify the end design. Do you see the difference there? So there's a difference between someone saying, I need my own site because, or I need my own site, that's not valid, but I need to be able to access my site from my iPad. That might very well be a valid technical requirement. Now, the next sets of requirements are your project requirements, budget, deadlines, those kinds of things that are driving the project. Then you've got your information architecture requirements, which we've talked about, how information is described, organized, and discovered. Then your information management requirements, which we've defined as how content is created, secured, maintained, disposed of over time. And then finally, your service level management requirements, which are generally about IT assurance. How available does this service need to be? How is it being backed up? What are the disaster recovery requirements? So these are all things that end up defining service level agreements, SLAs, and service level objectives, SLOs. So you're going to be in a requirements gathering stage getting all kinds of input, and it will be very helpful if you then take all that input you've gotten and put it into these buckets. You don't have to do them in any order. You can just go to gather requirements, but put them into these buckets. Does this make sense so far? All right. Once you've got them in the buckets, then you're going to be able to go into the next phases very logically. Now, this particular diagram shows what I've found as a consultant as generally the right way to gather requirements. And it really is going to, and when you get these slides, this is really about making sure that people are giving you the requirements you need and not giving you requirements you don't need. So what this diagram shows you is that what people should be giving you really are business requirements, technical requirements as a starting point. The business requirements will say, we want to do X. That then leads you to an exercise where you say, okay, in order for you to do X, you're going to be working with this type of information. If you're going to be having a recruit, if you're going to support collaboration around recruiting, one of the classes of information you're going to be working with is a resume, right? And in that resume, there's going to be personally identifiable information about the applicants. If you're also going to be doing some other type of activity, you're going to have a different type of information. So you're able to derive the types of information you're working with in that top green section. Then, once you've done that, you put that through your company's information management policies. So your information management policies are something that are also given to you. Now, you may or may not have written policies. It may be that you have to sit down and say, okay, what is the requirement for a resume? And someone might say, well, you have to keep a resume for 4 years. But there is a point there where you put the information classes through your information management policy, and that should drive to your information management requirements. Basically, the idea here is that no one should say, we have to do X with this data. We have to retain it for 5 years. We have to do whatever. There has to be a policy you can trace that requirement back to. So these green boxes are what I call derived requirements. They're things that are coming from previous requirements in the chain. Someone should not introduce a new requirement to one of these green boxes. It should be something that you can always go back and say, why are we doing it this way? Why are we doing it this way? Because there was a requirement that drove to it. So this drives to your information management requirements. Your technical requirements are generally going to lead to service management requirements. So that there might be a technical requirement for iPad access, for example, and that will affect how you build your service. Finally, these two things together lead to your service architecture, which is where we're going to keep going with the session. The information architecture is generally going to come out of the understanding of what types of information you're dealing with. So you end up with your information architecture and your service architecture. And just to really emphasize this one more time, this is why someone shouldn't say what your service should be. Someone shouldn't go directly to that box and say our service needs to do X. You should always be able to go back and say why, because there's a requirement from the business, there's a requirement for certain technology, or there's a policy that got us to this place. And as a consultant, I find about 80% of my time with customers is spent gathering requirements. If I can go into a customer and they can say, here's our requirements, the job is basically done. It becomes very easy. And often I'm at a point where the other challenge that I find as a consultant is we get down to these later stages of the process and someone introduces a new business requirement or introduces a new technical requirement. And as soon as they do that, you have to go back and do the process again to adjust for that new requirement. And so it does require a lot of discipline in your organization to say, no, stop, we're not taking any more business requirements. And part of governance is creating a process that is ongoing. SharePoint, unlike any other technology most of us have implemented, is not one you're going to roll out next year and wait for 3 years for the next version. It's not like Exchange or even Windows or Office. You're going to roll it out next year, and 3 months later, you're going to add new functionality, and 2 weeks later, you're going to add new functionality, and it's going to keep going. So you need to have a process that allows people to understand that SharePoint is different, that they don't have to get everything into the system right now, that it's a service that will grow with the organization. So don't let yourself get too far down here and have new requirements introduced. Any questions on that, those concepts? All right. So the second step is taking those requirements and throwing out all of the information architecture requirements and all of the primarily information architecture requirements, and really focusing on the management requirements, the information management and service management requirements. This is what you've got to do right now, and don't let people get distracted with information architecture in this phase. So for example, there are certain reasons why you might need more than one web application in your architecture. We've already talked about the idea that if you want podcasts on your intranet, but you don't want MP3s in your team sites, you have to do that with separate web applications. What are some of the other things that are scoped to a web application in SharePoint? Sorry? Authentication is to a point in that your mode of authentication, classic versus claims, is scoped at the web application. The actual authentication providers, particularly in 2010, are scoped to the zones. So then there's a subtle difference there. But let's say, for example, that your intranet, that part of your requirements is to provide a company-wide intranet, and part of your requirements is to support a line of business application that was built on SharePoint. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, that that line of business application was written 3 years ago, and you've done some testing, and you found it doesn't work under claims authentication. But you really want to use claims authentication for your intranet for whatever other requirements drove you to that. In order to use claims in your intranet and classic for your old application, you must put it in two different web apps. So the mode of authentication is definitely one. What else? Sorry? Quotas are actually done at the site collection level, but that's good. Quota templates you can define at the web app level and say each new site collection, the default template is X. But the actual quotas are assigned at the site collection level. Content databases, right? A web application can only have one content database. So if you want content for whatever performance reasons, perhaps, to be on two different SQL servers, you're going to have two content databases. And that cannot be... Sorry, let me put that the other way. Yeah, you can within one web application, you can have a content database being used by more than one web application, so that's correct. It's a reverse scope, yep. Sorry? The service applications that are available, that's a really good one. So let's assume that one of your business requirements is to support collaboration with partners and customers on an extranet. So in that scenario, and I'm going to actually draw this one here. So we have our sort of internal stuff that we're doing. And as part of our internal stuff, we have a taxonomy, right? And in that taxonomy, there's all kinds of terms. And those terms can be scoped to particular metadata fields and columns in SharePoint. So a column can have a list of choices that come from that metadata. But if you use keyword fields in SharePoint, a user can enter any term that's in any term set in your managed metadata service. So there are ways that users can basically see all your terms within a single term store. Now, that might be fine for all of your internal stuff, but then for your partners, you're gonna have to find some way to ensure that if you're using keywords, they don't see all the terms in your term store, but rather can only see the terms that you want. In order to do that, you're going to have a separate term store scoped for your extranet. So you have a taxonomy, a term store, with a limited set of terms that is linked to your extranet. That term set will then be the only one visible to your extranet. Your internal applications will use your internal term store and perhaps also your external term set. A web application can be associated with more than one managed metadata service. So your internal users can use any term from either term store. Your external users can only see the terms from the external term store. Because service applications are associated with web applications, the correct logical architecture for these two containers would have to be separate web applications. An extranet web application, an intranet web application. Very good one. And that's one that I find people forgetting a lot, is that the association with services is scoped at the web application level, and that does come back to bite you later if you don't have enough web apps. What else? All right, let's take a look at the list. Blocked file types we talked about earlier. The DNS namespace, that's an obvious one. If you want to have a different URL for whatever reason, the most common way to do that is with separate web apps. Website service isolation. Remember that a SharePoint web application is also an IIS website. And by having two, if you want to isolate two sets of functionality from each other, you will have to put those, from a process perspective, you'll have to put those in two separate web apps so they can be in two separate web application pools in IIS. Similarly, by having two separate web apps, you can choose to load balance the performance of those. So you might say, our project web application, we want to be on some dedicated servers, so as though users are working hard, they're not pounding the team sites. If we have those things in two separate web apps, we can use our load balancer and DNS to point the service to the project over to servers A and B, to point the service for the team sites to servers C and D. Now, when you create a web application in SharePoint, as you probably know, it creates the web application on all web front-end servers. So it's not like that web applications don't exist on every server, but with DNS and load balancing, you can point users to a subset of your servers. So website service isolation, both for servers and application pools. We talked about authentication. Self-service site creation. Some organizations like, I'm not a huge fan of it, but some organizations like allowing users to use the out-of-box self-service site creation, perhaps for their team sites, but they wouldn't be so wild about doing that for their intranet. Another reason to have team sites in a separate web application from the intranet. Automatic deletion of unused sites. Again, perhaps on your team sites, not on your intranet. Basically, if you look at central administration on the web application management page, everything in this box is scoped to the web application level. So if you need more than one of them, you must have more than one web application, more than one definition of blocked file types, more than one definition of self-service site creation, more than one definition of resource throttling, separate web apps. Couple more, SharePoint Designer controls. SharePoint Designer controls allow you to restrict certain behaviors in SharePoint Designer. Now, this particular management control is one of the few that actually can be scoped at more than one place. You can scope SharePoint Designer restrictions either at the web application level or, in most cases, at the site collection level as well. The impact of upgrade. If you are going to upgrade into the next version of SharePoint, let's say you're already in SharePoint 2010 and you're looking at how do you get to Wave 15, you basically, as you've discovered with your previous migrations, you're going to be doing it at least a web application at a time because there's a DNS issue where your DNS that was pointing to the old farm now needs to point to the new farm. If everything's in a single web app, it makes it a lot harder to upgrade one little piece without upgrading the whole shebang. Does that make sense? So the impact of upgrade is a big one. We talked about service application connections and configuration. So that's the web application level. Now, within a web application, you have at least one zone. Every web application has a default zone, and then you can add additional zones to it. The things that are on this part of the interface are those that are scoped to your zones. These include things like anonymous access. So if you want a certain set of content to be available anonymously and also to be available with requiring authentication, you would require two different zones on the same content to support that. So anonymous access, anonymous policy, which is related. SSL requires a zone. So let's say you have a requirement that a certain set of content, when it's accessed from your extranet, must be accessed through SSL. But when someone's accessing it from inside your network, you don't want to incur the overhead of SSL, so you want it to be available on port 80. In order to support both port 80 and port 443 for the same content, that would have to be scoped with two separate zones on the same web application. Authentication providers we talked about. So if you want to have different authentication providers, you can do that with different zones, although as you probably know with SharePoint 2010 and claims-based authentication, you don't have to do it with separate zones anymore. A single zone can support Windows authentication and forms-based authentication and SAML token-based authentication. The limitation comes with something like forms-based authentication. Let's say you want to have forms-based authentication both against a SQL database of users and against an LDAP directory like Atom or Active Directory LDS. If you want to have two separate forms authentication providers on the same web app, you'll have to have two different zones. But you can have one forms, Windows, and SAML token all on a single zone now. User policy also scoped to a zone. Now, let me give you an example of user policy that I've actually run into a couple of customers. They had a business requirement or an information management requirement that users could modify data when they were on the internal network, but when they were coming in from home, all they could do was read the same data. Now, think about that one. You can't do that with permissions, can you? There's no permission that says, oh, you're inside, so you can contribute, but you're outside and you can read only. Same user, different access vectors. The only option there is to have two zones. where when they're on the internal network, they're coming through a zone that has no policy associated with it, so the permission gives them the permissions they need. But you have a zone that's exposed to your outside, that when a user comes through that zone and that URL, there's a user policy that denies write, for example, and denies delete. So when they go through that policy and go down, every permission applies, but they still can't write or delete. And that's a user policy example that would drive to multiple zones. So when you put all those things together, I know a lot of us are fairly new to sort of a more nuanced SharePoint architecture. I've had people ask me, Dan, what web app should I have? And this is sort of a not knowing anything about your requirements and knowing that Dan really wants to know your requirements first. Not knowing anything about your requirements, this is a decent list. When you put all the sort of information management things together as far as web apps and zones, you probably will want to have a separate web app for your intranet, your company-wide, employee-wide published content, a separate web app for your collaboration, that would be teams, departments, business units, an extranet as a separate web app so that it can be exposed through a separate set of processes to the outside, separate service applications, a separate web app for social, a separate web app for your public website, obviously, perhaps even move that onto a separate farm, and a separate web app for applications. Now, this is an interesting one that a lot of people don't think fully through, but let me give you an example of this. Let's say you're going to build a functional application like an expense reporting application. So you're going to spend some time building this application in SharePoint 2010. When you upgrade to the next version of SharePoint, that expense reporting application doesn't really need to be changed, does it? Because you built it to a certain set of requirements, and the requirements haven't changed. It's just that you want to move the rest of your environment to SharePoint version 15. So by having a separate web app under which you put functional applications like expense reports, that gives you the option when you upgrade to the next version of SharePoint to leave that on your old SharePoint 2010 farm, because those apps work. And you can just worry about moving everything else out over to the new version of SharePoint. So having an apps web app is something that I'm a big fan of for functional things like expense reports. Does that make sense? All right. And finally, for significant line of business apps. So let's say that you're going to do a CRM application or a project management application or something like that, ERP. I would probably put that in each of those in their own dedicated web apps for the same basic reason. It gives you the ability of dedicating servers, of dedicating process, of leaving it behind when you upgrade, all those kinds of things, putting each one of those in their own web app. Any questions on this list? Yeah. So to repeat this so everyone can hear, a statement was that this looks like it's for a very big farm, and you know what? How does it apply to a smaller organization? This has nothing to do with user size. This has to do with information and service management requirements. And in many organizations, including my own small business as a consultant, I had certain information management requirements that drove me to have an extranet as a separate web app for my intranet. Terms are an example, backup and restore SLAs. We all have the same requirements. We may have, I may have requirements 1, 2, and 3, you may have 2, 3, and 4. So we have slight differences, but there's a lot of overlap. And it's really an issue of looking at your requirements and seeing where they lead you. And this is a very typical place, even in a small organization. And you don't necessarily have to do it right the first time. If you do put everything into a single web app, that's fine. You just have to recognize that you're going to eventually feel pain. And the pain might be, oh my gosh, our clients can see private terms in our term store. And you have to realize that the reason that's happening is because you put everything in a single web app and you scoped a single service application. So it's not that you have to do it all at once, but you have to know where you're heading. And it certainly does make sense, in my opinion, for some of these things like this that are a little bit more universal, to architect it this way to start with, because I can tell you I'm with far more clients that are saying, gosh, I wish we had done this 3 years ago, than I am with clients who say, oh, we really haven't used any of those web apps. So the real answer is you have to look at your requirements, but this is about requirements, not about size. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah, so his question is about once you start dividing into multiple containers, all kinds of things get tougher, including lookups. And that is true. And it's an issue of looking at your information management requirements, which usually can only be achieved one way, versus a functional requirement, like we want data, you know, here from over there, which can usually be achieved 10 ways. And that's why it's important that you design an architecture based on your information management requirements, because there's usually only one answer. The answer will be different for each of you based on your own requirements, but there's going to be really only one way you can build SharePoint to meet your information management requirements, and then you'll go, gosh, now it's hard to do this, and you'll have to find a solution, but there's usually five ways to find a solution. And that's again, that yin and yang. Some things get more difficult as you add more containers to your world. Now, multiple farms. Let's talk about that for a second. Let's switch over to OneNote. What are some reasons why in the world you might want to have more than one farm? Licensing, like enterprise versus standard?
No,
internal versus external, absolutely. That's a good reason. What else? And I already gave away one. Enterprise versus standard. I have some customers who are like, oh, you know, this certain set of users really needs InfoPath, but we can't afford it for every user. So they sign up a farm, you know, with Enterprise Cal for those users. What else? Internet, www versus internal stuff. Yep, absolutely. Development environments. That's an obvious one, right? Yeah. And I just so you know, I have had people come up to me and say, Dan, we don't have a test environment. My answer is no, you don't have a production environment. Yeah. It's amazing how the budget increases when you position it that way. It's all about risk, and that's a you know, I give that to you as a little aside, so that if you do need to justify the cost of a dev environment or a production environment, that is exactly how you position it. And it may not be your boss who cares about that, but if you go high enough up, someone's going to say, oh my God, that's right, isn't it? So yeah, dev versus test versus production, multiple farms. What else? Sorry? Different locations, yes. As you know, SharePoint is really not designed to be geo-distributed. Your front-end servers and your SQL servers on the back-end have to have very, very basically LAN speed types of connectivity. So if you've got users in you know, around your data center, let's say here in the Gold Coast, and you've also got a development team, let's say in China, and the Chinese team needs to do document-based collaboration, which is where it gets particularly painful, the question is, do you have your remote team uploading and downloading documents over your WAN, which is going to be slow, or do you give them their own farm to do collaboration, and then that way they can do their uploading and downloading of documents at basically local speeds, but then maybe search and social and enterprise intranet and things like that are more read-only web apps are still done in the data center. So geo performance is a big reason for having multiple farms. Different farms in different locations serving different business purposes. Now, a couple of notes about that. First of all, in a lot of those scenarios, I have customers doing a lot of that. That remote farm ends up being a SharePoint Foundation farm, right? Which is free. And that farm out there is still being indexed by the Enterprise Search Service, which is in the central location, which you know itself incurs a little bit of performance impact, but it's a lot cheaper way of sort of getting good geo performance. I'll give you another story related to that. I had a mining company as a customer, and they were amazingly good at network infrastructure. I mean, they were just like rocket scientists when it came to satellites and different types of connections. And they basically said, Dan, we can solve any network problem, so we're going to have one SharePoint farm. Okay, which is fine, except for the fact that they were skipping all the requirements bits. And one of the business requirements was emergency response procedures. We need to provide that. We want to provide centralized access to emergency response procedures. Now, emergency response procedures in a single centralized SharePoint farm are great until the day your network connection just disappears because of a hurricane or a tsunami. And then, as soon as we looked at that, they're like, oh my gosh, we have to have local farms, don't we? Mm-hmm. So you always have to start with your business requirements. Don't just jump to we're good at X or Y. What are you really trying to do with your SharePoint farm? So geo performance is a good one. So that's a good start. Let's take a look at that list on the slide here. So code isolation is one. The idea being that if you want to run if you're going to install a really significant SharePoint application, you might want to isolate that code entirely so that your normal farm isn't impacted by that code. Again, perhaps for upgrade purposes, that means your normal farm is clean. Your line of business application, you can remediate separately. So code isolation is one thing that sort of ties into licensing as well. Dev, test, staging, and production falls into that. You want to isolate test code until it has been proven. We already talked about that. Access different farms, so your public-facing website versus your extranet versus your intranet. Geo-performance we talked about. Feature and process isolation. This is that sort of idea that in a lot of, this is particularly larger organizations, it makes sense to start thinking about having a clean enterprise service farm that is basically running search, profiles, metadata, and BCS. And those services can then be published to all the other farms within your SharePoint service. So that keeps this really clean, really centralized, it's going to make it a lot easier to upgrade to the next version of SharePoint. And then you have content farms that consume those services, and those content farms you go bananas with customizing. So that's one example there. Premium farms for custom applications. If you think about having multiple farms, it has some interesting implications for you. One is it allows you to give different SLAs to different organizations. So you might have a very different SLA for disaster recovery for your finance and operations group than you need to for your marketing group. So by having those as separate farms, you might be able to replicate, you know, the core content and not worry so much about other things that don't matter within your organization. So SLAs can be defined very differently. Chargeback becomes possible. I just had a conversation with someone this morning about this, where by putting a line of business application in a separate farm, it makes it a lot easier to go to that part of your organization and say, you actually need to chip in for this. We're not going to make this part of the enterprise SharePoint service. This is really just about supporting sales. So sales kind of needs to help pay for this. So chargeback becomes a little bit more possible. And also upgrading to the next version of SharePoint we talked about. And even thinking about moving out to the cloud and saying, okay, this certain thing can go in the cloud. Our extranet, very common scenario right now. Extranet, we're targeting to move into Office 365 next year. I'm hearing that a lot. Everything else stays inside, but we're tired of letting people through our firewalls and through our reverse proxies, so we're going to put our extranet out in Office 365. So now we move down a little bit lower in the stack to multiple site collections. We've already talked about the idea of ownership. HR wants ownership of their information. They don't want anyone else in there. Finance wants ownership of their information. Ownership is defined by who's in the site collection administrators group. Those people have, by default, cannot change full access content, full access to all content, and the ability to turn on and off features, to add things and destroy things within that site collection. So to have separate business ownership, it really is going to be separate site collections. That's what we've talked about. Quotas, someone mentioned. If you have all of your team sites in a single site collection, and you set a quota of 100 gigabytes, that is applied to the collection of sites. If engineering is one of those teams, yeah, you get the idea. Your AutoCAD documents and images and GIS information is going to fill up that 100 gigabytes, and marketing and HR aren't going to have a chance of putting anything in that site collection. So you're going to have separate site collections to support different quotas. That's the only way those can be scoped. Locks, where you set a site to read only, that's done at the site collection level. SharePoint designer restrictions can be done at the web app level or the site collection level. Features, turning them on or off. Now, this has an implication for two reasons. One is, if everyone's in one site collection and you turn on a feature, that means that feature might be visible to everyone, and now that means you have to train them as to should they use it, shouldn't they use it, why should they use it. If you have different site collections, you can turn on, let's say, the content organizer for legal, and you don't have to worry about training sales about how to use the content organizer. Also, there's a licensing issue. A lot of tools are licensed per site collection, and so you might be able to restrict licensing a little bit better that way. Sandbox solutions are turned on or off at the site collection level, and the solutions run within the resource pool of the site collection. And search settings. There's a number of different search settings scoped at the site collection level. And finally, audit settings. So finance may require real heavy auditing. Marketing may not. If you put them in the same site collection, you're going to have to audit everything, including marketing, more heavily, which means your logs are going to be bigger, harder to parse, harder to get the information out. Put them in separate site collections. You can have separate settings and more effective auditing. So when you look at this list, I would propose that you should consider site collections as the management container of SharePoint. Almost all of the really key information management requirements lead you to multiple site collections. And so, well, you know, some of these may be more or less important to each of you, but you really end up at a point where the site collection is really king, and that's what you're going to do a lot of. And just to draw a parallel for those of you who don't know, if you go to Office 365 and you sign up, you get an account, what you are getting is a site collection. And that ensures that you have access to it, no one else does. If you do something stupid in your sandbox, it doesn't hurt anyone else. All of those things are scoped to that site collection. And also user and group management, and this is a really key one as well. If you think about the HR example, if HR was in the same site collection as finance, then when you add users to the groups in SharePoint, those are getting added to the site collection, not to the individual site, which means that both the finance and HR users are defined in the same table. And what that can potentially lead to is problems where access isn't being managed correctly, and someone in HR accidentally gives Joe from finance permission instead of giving Joe from HR permission. And so by having separate site collections, you can guarantee that the definition of users is more scoped, which means reporting is easier, security management is easier. So that's another key one at the site collection level. So you end up with a lot of site collections as you start looking at these requirements. Any questions about these? All right. As a slight digression, I want to talk through a scenario that is, that people usually start thinking about at this point. Let's say that we've got these web applications for the internet and for our teams. We've got site collections for HR and finance so that we can scope ownership appropriately. Now we have a cross-departmental function. Let's say that we're going to start analyzing benefits for next year for employees. There are going to be some people from finance and some people from HR working on a team to do that. The first thing we have to think about is where should that team do its collaboration? Should it do it in HR? No, because we know finance can't get into HR, and probably the same the other way around. What we probably need to do is spin up a site collection specifically for that team, for that project. Now, that will also have the benefit of when we're done analyzing benefits for next year, we can archive that site and get rid of it, right? Instead of trying to jam it into an existing container in our environment. So we spin up that benefits team site, and they start working on defining benefits. They're going to collaborate, they're going to do what they need to do, and when they're all done, that definition of benefits needs to be visible to everyone in the organization. We need to publish it. And the question becomes, do we give everyone permission to this, or do we take this and move it into a container that's really scoped to be everyone, which would be the intranet, that really is sort of designed for read-only information across organization. This becomes a much more valuable way to deal with the scenario of taking information and copying, moving, replicating, whatever the case may be, and getting that information into the right container, because this information now is different than what it was when it was here. When it was here, we were collaborating on it. We were deciding what it should be. We were working around it. When we're done, we're done. It actually becomes a different type of information subject to different management requirements, which include visibility to everyone. And so we move it into a new location. That gives us the option over time of archiving that site and getting rid of it internally. So you do need to think about the entire life cycle of your content, and keep in mind that content that falls into one bucket of information today, being collaborative, might suddenly become published tomorrow, and that's okay. Questions about that concept? All right. Multiple content databases. You will probably need more than one. It's all about storage management. Everything about storage is scoped at the content database level, like which SQL server actually has the database. You might want to spread databases across certain servers just for performance reasons or whatever other reasons you've got. That's scoped at the content database level. Redundancy. You might have certain content that needs to be replicated and made redundant and other content that doesn't. Mirroring is done at the content database level. So if you turn on mirroring for one part of your organization, you can leave it off for a different part of your organization by having separate scopes. Backup and restore. If you put all of your content for your team sites in a single content database, that's going to take a long time to back up. And I'm sure some of us in this room have run into scenarios where all of a sudden we couldn't finish backing up overnight because our content databases were so big. Splitting that up into separate scopes gives us a better opportunity of meeting that SLA. And on the flip and more important side, recovery. Someone calls up and says, I need to restore XYZ. If you're having to pull a 1 terabyte content database off of your backup system, just getting that back before you can even begin recovery might take too long. You might not be able to meet your recovery SLAs.
So this boils down to those service management requirements that might drive you to have multiple content databases, perhaps on multiple servers, that kind of thing. And finally, PowerShell delegation is done at the content database level. And remote blob store, at least with the file stream provider, is turned on and off at the content database level as well. So multiple content databases. So we've seen now how our management requirements lead us into lots and lots and lots of containers. Multiple farms, multiple web apps, multiple site collections, content databases, zones, service applications, et cetera. And all of that was done not really thinking about how users are going to get to content, but really just about what requirements we have to manage content a certain way. Any questions about that? All right. Now we go to the third step, which is really the easiest one, which is once we've decided what our architecture needs to look like to meet our requirements, then we can take the web apps and site collections that we've built and we can create subsites based on the fact that we need subset of permissions or a feature turned on like blogs, things like that. So you'll do a little bit of a refinement where you basically take your existing architecture and maybe you divide it up just a little bit more. You won't be moving things around because where things are is based on requirements, but you might be able to refine it just a smidge. So creating that subsite for blogs, for example. And last but not least, we get to overlaying your information architecture. So this gets to that great divide, that yin and yang, where our management requirements pushed us to more containers, but most of SharePoint's out-of-box features for manageability are scoped to a site collection. So adding, you know, if a user needs read access to multiple teams, we're now having to add that user to multiple site collections in order to do that. So manageability suddenly becomes much harder. Navigation becomes much more harder. When you add a site to a site collection, you get a link for free. When you add a new site collection, it's up to you. So behind the scenes, you have this crazy architecture based on your requirements, whatever that might look like, multiple farms perhaps even. And the presentation to the user needs to look very, very logical. It needs to follow your information architecture. Now, this is definitely possible, and there are several ways to do it. The first is to manually configure navigation. And this sounds really gruesome, but I've done it enough times to tell you it's not that bad, and I'll show you an example in just a second. You can manually configure a navigation. You can create custom link lists. So we all know what a link list is in SharePoint. You can say, you know, finance is at this URL, HR is at this URL, and you can even then security trim or, you know, set permissions on the items in that list. So if I'm in HR, I see the link to HR, but I don't see the link to finance. Easy way to create navigation. There's lots of custom or third-party navigation controls, including on CodePlex, so there's ways to build navigation in. And let me give you an example of what I've done in this environment of my intranet. So let's jump up into our VM, which we really didn't spend much time in. But here is our intranet. And you'll notice that the URL is a web app for the intranet. Now, from the intranet, a user in finance can click finance, and they get to the finance intranet site. So this is where finance would basically say, our stock price today is X. And, you know, we're on track to meet our budget. Public information. Now, a user in finance can might drop choose to drop further down into the finance team site. And when they do that, they get to the finance team site. But notice where what we've done is we've actually jumped to another web application. So we just put on the navigation a manual link to the team site for finance. And once they're in here, they can drill down from here. And, of course, this would only be accessible to members of that team. So let's go back a level. All employees can start at the intranet, drop down into finance, and go into expense reports. And when they get into expense reports, they are actually going into a web app dedicated to little functional applications like our expense report application, separate web app with a site collection just for that one functional application. Going back, I think that's pretty much what I want to show you there. Yeah, HR has the same kinds of things, so they can drop into their team site. And just to point out one other little thing here, when a user goes down deep, let's say into the finance team site, they can get back up the navigation. So the links that we've been seeing are just adding links to the global navigation. This is a very less understood navigation element, which you configure from site settings. And in site settings, what you look for is the portal site connection, which is right here. And the portal site connection is a URL. And it sounds really cool. It sounds like you're actually connecting to something and making something happen. All you're doing is adding that one little link in that drop-down list to allow you to go up to a higher level. It's purely a navigation thing. So you can add that navigation into your environment, and you can basically create an information architecture. There's also ways of doing it dynamically where, you know, you basically generate a site navigation based on what's currently in your farm. Watch out if you're going to develop that, though, because you can really hit performance very, very hard. You don't want that happening every time any user opens a page. You want it to be something that it refreshes a navigation maybe every 15 minutes or half hour or overnight, and that then becomes the static navigation that's rendered to users, so you don't hit performance too hard. So you can deal with navigation and presenting it to users effectively. Search-based navigation is also something to get very comfortable with. It's the wave of the future, where instead of giving users a fixed way of clicking to things, you're giving them search-based tools that give them query-based results of certain sites in your environment. The other thing you really have to worry about is administration. Now that you have all these potentially farms, site collections, web applications, servers, how do you administer these with a single pane of glass? And single pane of glass is a term I heard Microsoft use yesterday. A lot of the ISVs like using it. But you do need to think about how you're going to pull audit reports across your entire service now that your service is very distributed. And PowerShell is your friend, and we'll see an example of that in just a minute. And then, of course, there's third-party applications that give you single pane of glass administration as well. But you're going to have to figure out in advance how to tackle that because it is tough. And there's other things like lookups and other business challenges that do become trickier as you divide your environment. So in sum, we started off, we've been through this four-step process of going from requirements to specific architectures and then overlaying information architecture and manageability at the end. We talked about the requirements that you gather and what they lead to. All of this leads to an architecture that might be very distributed but still can be both presented to users and even administered in a very logical way. We started this journey with the idea that governance is people, policy, process, and technology that surround a service. And if you do this right, there's one more piece to the picture, which is management. Now, management is the technical layer of how you manage the service to achieve what the governance plan is asking for. So governance is asking for something, the service is doing something, management is the layer that makes it all possible and preferably automated. So just as a little bit of an example, let me show you here what we can actually do. We have this Teams web application, and this Teams web application has on it a place where I can request a Teams site. This is just a list, and I'm going to go in and fill in that I want a site for benefits. I put in a description, I pick a business owner, and this is something I built. This is not out of box. I just built a little list here. And I can pick whether this is a department, a meeting, or a team. We'll pick team. And so I can enter this request. Now, of course, you know that there's workflows. We could build a workflow where a manager has to approve this request, blah, 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 blah. We cut a little bit further down the line, and I've got a scheduled task that runs every hour that runs a script called site provisioning. Site provisioning goes and looks at that list and finds any approved request that has not yet been fulfilled, and this script runs as a scheduled task. It creates a content database with the name that I've specified, so this team gets its own content database. It will then create a site collection in that content database. It will add the business owner as the secondary site collection administrator, and in my governance plan, the SharePoint administrator gets to be primary owner of each site collection. And then it also is going to do some other things as well that allow us to implement our specific governance plan. And in our governance plan, we specify that versioning must be on for team sites and that checkout must be enforced. And we can actually do that as part of this script. So it's creating the site collection now. Hopefully this won't take too terribly long here. And the idea is because we have specific rules based on our requirements, we can start building automation tools that get us where we want to go, where we can start either delegating to users or at least stepping back from the daily grind of having to enforce these policies every time a user asks for something. So we got that site created. Let's go take a look at it here. teams.contoso.com/teams/benefits. And you can do some amazing things with PowerShell as far as sort of jury-rigging your own governance enforcement. So when we go into, for example, the shared documents document library here and into its settings, we'll see that this has been set to enforce versioning. Whoops, something went wrong. I'll have to check my script. But the script does have it in there. I must have just blown something up there. So that management layer can be added if you have good architecture to support good requirements. Now, a couple of last notes here. On the slide deck, there is a whole set of resources for you. I'll be happy to also stick around and answer questions for you. This is a list of my schedule coming up. Tomorrow, I'm doing a session on storage optimization, capacity. You all know that Microsoft expanded the capacity guidance for storage and also remote blob store. That'll be tomorrow. We're doing our pseudo book cover signing tomorrow at lunchtime, so come on by for that to down in the expo hall. And if you've got any questions, I'll stick around and ask. I do want to clear off the stage for the previous or for the next speaker, but if you want to come up, I'll be happy to answer questions. Also, do not hesitate to shoot me questions by email. Oh, and one last note that I didn't mention, AvPoint.com, my company's website, we are doing a webinar series called SharePoint Uncensored. And what I showed you at the very end there about starting to automate governance is a session that I'll be finishing and delivering at the end of September as part of the webinar series. It's free. So if you go up to AvPoint.com, you'll find the webinar series. You can sign up for it. You can either watch it live or get the recording. And we also have a previous version of this presentation up there if you want it as well. So thank you guys very much for coming. Look forward to seeing you. Please do fill in your evaluations. They're super important. Thanks.